Sermons from the Journey is the audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Becca Gorell, pastor at Lebanon United Methodist Church in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and blogging at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening. I know a person, not just one person, a conglomeration of people, if you will. I know a person who is a victim, who is a survivor of domestic violence. I know a doctor. I know a teacher. I know a pastor. I know a janitor. I know a person who delivers mail and a person who packages groceries. I know a person who is a stay-home parent and a person who works long hours on the road. You know a person, not just one person, a conglomeration of people. You know a person who is a victim, who is a survivor of domestic violence. You know a person who is very young. You know a person who is very old. You know a person who has been living with their partner for 2 weeks. You know a person who has been married to their spouse for 2 decades. A person of any gender, a person of any socioeconomic status, a person in a relationship with someone of the same gender or someone of a different gender. I know a person, you know a person, many, many people who are survivors. Domestic violence is something we don't like to talk about. That's why we designate a month, really, to be Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so that we can talk about it, because we must talk about it. The greatest ally of domestic violence is silence, is stigma, is that which keeps it hidden so that we don't have to talk about it. But domestic violence impacts an average in the United States of 20 people per minute. Per minute. This worship service will be approximately, and I do say approximately, 60 minutes long. 60 times 20, am I right, is 1,200 people. In the time that we are gathered together to worship God and give thanks, in the time that we are gathered together to bring a little bit of light to this subject, 1,200 people. Domestic violence impacts one out of every 3 to 4 women. And lest we think it is a women's issue, one out of between every 4 to 5 men. And in every household where there are children, it does not matter if the children are themselves the targets of the physical or verbal or emotional attack, it impacts each and every child who witnesses this violence in any form. Most disturbingly to me, most disheartening to me, statistically there is no difference for either the victims of domestic violence nor the perpetrators of domestic violence based on church attendance. That means that people who attend church are just as likely to be in and remain in violent relationships, just as likely to be both the victims and the perpetrators of violence as anyone else. I'm grateful that the number isn't higher, quite frankly, but I'm disheartened that it isn't lower. Recently, there was a video, a surveillance tape released of an NFL player who was assaulting his then-fiance, now spouse. And in the fallout of that being made public, a lot of attention has been shed, thankfully, on the topic of domestic violence. However, a lot of the questions centered around why this woman married this man. Why did she stay in this relationship? And so people started sharing their stories. And on Twitter, you can kind of give a little hashtag. I don't know how familiar you are with Twitter, but it's a group of characters that basically helps categorize a conversation. And sometimes people start talking about something enough, it becomes a really powerful and really well-spread conversation online. And so this conversation started with people, mostly women, but men as well, with the topic, why I stayed. And people shared their stories, very, very brief stories, of why they stayed in relationships that were physically, emotionally, verbally, sexually abusive. And thankfully, beautifully, people also started a conversation with a similar topic, why I left, how people were able to find the strength to leave those relationships that were damaging to them physically, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically. What was heartbreaking to me was how often the church was named in the first conversation. And if I saw it at all, it was very, very few and far between how often the church was named in the second. People who shared things like, church has taught me that wives should be submissive to their husbands, and I was being submissive to my partner. People who shared things like, I was told that it wasn't nice or Christian to press charges against someone, so I did not. People who shared, my pastor told us that we had to save our marriage at all costs. People who said, I just worried what the other folk at church would think of me if they knew what happened in our family. The stigma and shame and fear that is already surrounding those who are caught in a cycle of violence, victim and perpetrator, together in a cycle of violence so difficult to break, the silencing already placed upon that, compounded by the church, by the people of God, it breaks my heart. I believe it breaks the heart of God even more. Because you see, even though domestic violence happens in every community, in every, yes, congregation, in every part of the country and part of the world, when we don't talk about it and when we silence it, it helps push the people who are at the very center of our communities and families and lives to the margins of those families. And I believe that Jesus has a special place in his heart for people on the margins, for people pushed out to the edges, for people silenced or ashamed or alone or afraid, who dare not speak out, who don't know how they will find the strength. That's what I love about this passage, this story. It tells the story of two people. They happen to be female people. And again, I want to stress that this is an issue that impacts people regardless of gender. But when we're talking about the marginalization of people, particularly in the time and place that this story was written, women are of very little societal worth at the time. And when women are of societal worth, it's between two places in their lives, between the times that they enter puberty and before the time that they enter menopause, because that's when women can produce children. And so we hear the story of two people. We hear the story of a girl about 12 years of age, right on one of those cusps. And we hear the story of a woman who's been suffering from some sort of menstrual disorder for 12 years and has used up all the money she has. That sounds like the other end of the spectrum there. So we are hearing about two women who are not of childbearing value, to be frank, pushed to the margins of the society because they are women, because they are either too young or too old. In the case of the young girl, she is the daughter of one of the synagogue leaders, but Jesus has been having a little bit of a contentious relationship with the leaders of the synagogues, if you haven't noticed that in the Bible. And so this seems an unlikely person for him to help. But he does. The other woman is someone that he cannot and should not touch if he, as a man, would like to remain ritually pure to enter the synagogue in prayer himself, to enter the temple in prayer, to enter the presence of other people in prayer. A woman with a hemorrhage is ritually unclean and is meant to be kept apart from society, literally pushed out to the margins of society. This is why she comes to Jesus when there's a crowd. Safety in numbers, right? No one's going to notice that it's her, because I bet if it's been 12 years and she's seen every doctor in town, everybody knows who that woman is. And everybody knows you do not touch her, and you do not let her touch you, because she will make you unclean. Anybody, she will make you unclean. But in the crowd, there's safety in numbers, and she's tried everything else. And she is desperate for someone just to hear her or see her or touch her as a human being. She is craving that contact, that help. She is crying out. And maybe in the crowd, she won't be noticed, and it will be safer. And she says to herself, I don't even need to touch him and worry about making him unclean if I could just touch his clothes. In some translations and tellings of the story, even she goes to touch just the fringe of his cloak, the tassel on the end of it, just the fringe. Of course, fringe also meaning margin or edge, right? If I can touch just the tiniest edge of his clothes, I will be made well. And Jesus, of course, knows this. He feels it. He can tell. She is made well. It is amazing, but it's not without his knowledge. And he knows that this has happened. And he goes looking for the person who's touched him, which his disciples say, well, that's kind of silly. There's like a million people around here. How could, of course, somebody touched you? He doesn't mean who bumped into me. He means who touched me deeply on a human level, who took from me healing power, who touched me authentically in that real human-to-human contact way that he recognizes that she has so sought after and longed for all these years, for someone to see her and touch her. And he sees her when she comes forward and she confesses and she says, it was me. You can imagine the crowds, again, those who know who she is, drawing back. And he says, your faith, not my magic power, your faith has made you well, daughter. Go, you are healed. He gives her back her strength and her confidence, her sense of self, and he lets her go forth into the community again to be someone who can be seen and touched and interacted with. The healing is so much more than knowing in her body that she is made well, but knowing in her spirit that she is made well, which, as any person who has suffered any physical abuse or physical trauma can tell you, it is the healing of the spirit that takes much longer. But that begins with Jesus seeing her, empowering her, and setting her free. Likewise, he sees the child who has also fallen victim to some pain, to some trauma, to some tragedy. He calls to her tenderly, little girl, get up. It is not too late. He does this privately in the safety and comfort of her home. How important it is when dealing with children who've experienced any trauma that they have a safe and comfortable place, that they have adults that they trust, but not a crowd pressing in, that they have that place to be spoken to gently, tenderly, and their immediate needs cared for. She gets up. And he says, now somebody get this girl something to eat. And she does. And he warns them not to speak of it, not to make a big deal of it. How hard it is when we have been through trauma to then have to talk about it over and over again. In this demonstration of compassion for the woman, for the girl, Jesus first and foremost sees them as people, sees their full humanity, gives them the dignity of being touched, of being healed, of having their needs met, of having their pain seen and held and heard. I have a Facebook friend, Dr. Christy Sim, who just recently received her doctorate with a focus on domestic violence and prayer and healing. And she wrote an article a couple weeks ago for Domestic Violence Awareness Month about what is it that we should do? What is it that we should do if there is someone that we suspect or that we want to help who is in a domestic violence situation? We know that if we're the person, you know, all we have to do is everything. All, you know, if we're the person in that situation, it's overwhelming for those who have been there, for those who are there. It is disempowering. You don't know where to start. It's clear that help is needed, but we don't know where. Like the woman pressing in the crowds from all sides, pressing around her, it seems overwhelming. And maybe just that little reaching out. How many times did she try to reach out? We don't know. But she had tried everything for 12 years and was no better, only worse. Likewise, when a person is locked in that cycle of violence, it's overwhelming to know where to find the strength and the courage and the power to reach out. But for those of us who see or suspect or have an inkling, how do we help? What do we say and do? And so Dr. Sim writes a few examples for those who would be allies. And she says, the first thing is to believe. No matter how bad it sounds, what you're being told, no matter how much you don't want to believe that, to believe, to let the person know, I believe you, I hear you, I see you. Like Jesus turning around in the crowd, I felt your touch. Like Jesus speaking to the little girl, young one, little girl, get up. I see you. I believe you. How powerful it is to be believed. Because a person coming forward, reaching out like the woman in the crowd, is doing so at tremendous risk and with tremendous, tremendous courage. And just to be heard and believed is the first step. The second thing she says is to validate what the person does well. Doesn't have to be about that. Can be about anything. A person who is staying in a relationship that is violent is probably, almost certainly, being told disparaging things about themselves on a daily or hourly basis. And so to be told and affirmed in something uplifting about themselves, and it can be anything, builds the confidence and courage that is so deeply needed. And it's linked to the next point, but we see it when Jesus says to the woman, it is your faith that has made you well. He affirms her faith and her courage. Because the next point is very simple and very similar and probably the hardest to live out, and that is that if we want to help, if you want to help, the best thing to do is to put aside the white horse. And the idea that we are the one that's going to ride in and save somebody. Because you see, somebody who's living in a situation of violence is probably also being told, being shown on a daily or hourly or moment-to-moment basis that they don't get to make decisions for themselves. They don't get to make decisions about their body. They don't get to make decisions about their space. They don't get to make decisions about what they say or where they go. And so if another person comes in and says, you must do this, you must do that, here's what we're going to do, I'm going to do this for you, well, we're just reinforcing the idea that a person doesn't get to make decisions for themselves. No, we provide information, we provide a listening ear, we tentatively mention, we're here if you want to develop a safety plan, but we give the person their own tools to reach out for themselves. Daughter, it is your faith that has made you well. Jesus doesn't just say, oh, someone here is hurting. Someone here is hurting. Let me come save you. Let me come heal you and rush over and lay his hands upon her. He feels her reach out to him. He feels that power has gone out from him, is what it says. And he turns to her and he says, "You have done this. Your faith has made you well. Your courage, your strength has made you well." Dr. Sim is clear that when there are cases of immediate life-threatening danger, that this rule can be put aside in favor of calling the authorities if we believe someone is in danger of losing their lives, that is the time for action. She says next, though, that we have to be patient. Patient as this woman was patient for 12 years. She sought doctor after doctor. In the same way, people who are in violent situations will seek opportunities to get out or to get help. People who are themselves abusers quite often will seek help a little bit here and there because there are treatment programs and things available for them as well. But that it takes, on average, 7 times for a person to leave a violent relationship or leave a violent home. And Dr. Sim calls the first 6 times practice. We just need practice. What's it going to look like? Where will we land? Who will be our support network? Who will be the people that will hold us up? How will we find the strength? And so this woman, too, was practicing reaching out, practicing asking for help. It takes practice, and we affirm that practice, not, oh, you tried, but you failed to get out. You practiced. You practiced. You learned a little bit more about your own strength and the strength of your community to support you. Dr. Sim says we are to be a constant, stable presence in the person's life. Unconditional love. Hey, we are the church. We should do this part really well. Unconditionally loving. Unconditionally there. No matter what. No matter how many times the person goes back. No matter how many times we feel we've heard the same story. That is not the issue. We are loving. We are there. And that importantly and somewhat difficultly, we must not model that one takes responsibility for an abusive person's behavior, but that the only person who can take responsibility for that is the abuser themselves. And here's what I mean by that. I mean that we don't say, or what she means by that, we don't say, "I'm so sorry that this person is doing that to you." That's a really common thing, perhaps, to say. But that kind of models that idea that someone else's behavior, that you can feel sorry or guilty or responsible for that. No, the only person who's in charge of their behavior is themselves. And the only person whose behavior I can control or be sorry about is my own. And so we try not to model or reinforce that, but instead to reinforce that everybody's responsible for their own behavior. These are just some practical suggestions of what we do when we're the one whose clothes have been touched, so the one that someone might be reaching out to. But I think, most importantly, we as the church have a very important gift to give, and that is that we are grounded in a present God, in a present Christ who sees and hears. The person in the crowd reaching out, the child that others say, "Oh, no, now it's really not worth it. She has died." We are grounded in a Christ who is present with us, who sees and hears the people others discount, and we can bring that grounding principle to all that we do. Break the silence. So often the rallying cry of those working against domestic violence to break the silence. And Christ is the great word spoken into the silence. That's what God does. God speaks into the silence and creation comes forth. Christ is the word spoken into the silence that breaks it, that shatters it, that opens it up. Christ sees, he feels, he hears, he believes when someone reaches out. I want to suggest that this might mean we have to rethink sometimes what the church says about marriage. We want to lift up marriage. It's important. We want to lift up and equip and strengthen healthy marriages. But I hear very clearly that critique. You know, it's easy to say, oh, our church isn't one that says that women must be subject to men. Our church isn't one that says that physical abuse is an okay part of marriage. And there are churches who say that. Ours isn't one, so we're okay. But I do hear that critique that we lift up, that we're gonna save marriage, we're gonna save your marriage, we're gonna, like, marriage is itself something that is in danger. Licensed social worker Teresa Little says, I'm not interested in saving a marriage. A marriage can be restored even after it's been broken. A life cannot. What if we are about promoting and equipping and supporting healthy relationships, healthy people, but saving people when that's needed? Not saving just an idea, but saving a person and then nurturing a healthy relationship, whatever that becomes. Ultimately, my prayer is that one day when people talk about why I stayed, they don't say because the church told me I had to. My prayer is that one day when people talk about how I came to a healthier place, how I got out, or how my relationship transformed, that's when they named church. Because my church taught me that Jesus feels even the faintest tug. And that gave me the courage to reach out. Because my church was a safe place where there were people I could talk to, the pastor, other people in the congregation that I knew would hear, would believe me. And that's how I had the strength and the support I needed. Because this was a place where I knew there was hope, there was healing to be had. What if people said, the reason I was able to transform my relationship is that the church was the place where I went and found that first step toward help for myself, for my violence and aggression and anger. And I got the help that I needed, and that's how I was transformed. What if people say the church was the place that I knew God heard me, God believed me? And if God was with me, then I could reach out, I could trust, I could cry out for help, and I could know that healing does come. If even one person says this, and then another and another. Come, holy day. Come, faith that makes us well.